Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to Up Front. I'm Chloe Morgan.
And I'm Rachel O'Sullivan.
On today's show, no rest for the wicked with a break in the WSL as the Conti Cup threw in a few surprises for us to chat about. We also preview England's international break with Friday's game against the USA, a sellout. And we look into the damning report that's just come out about the abuse across America's NWSL. Joining us today is an absolute legend. I mean, we had a couple of legends last week. We've had Jenna Scalacci, we've had, Football Beyond Borders, Rene Hector. But this week, it's big. It's bloody big. Our guest has played over 100 games for Chelsea, 18 times for England and for Team GB at London 2012, since retired, but still working in the game as a transfer wizard. It is none other than Claire Rafferty. Welcome, Claire.
Oi, hello everyone. How's it going? I was going to go, oi, oi.
I mean, if we'd have been in the studio, it would have been a bit of a hype man type thing. It's always lovely to have an absolute legend, hero, inspirational role model, transfer wizard on our podcast. I mean, that's pretty big. So, thanks so much for joining us today. All right, gang. I think we've got to start with the big Conti Cup fixtures this weekend. A couple of upsets, about 4,000 penalties that have taken place. and obviously for my own team, not the greatest of weekends. It's a competition that I absolutely love. I bloody love it. It feels to me like there's a big chance for, some of the younger players to come through, your second keepers to get a chance and a run out. You know, some of the championship squads getting that opportunity to, play against WSL squads, see how well they've recruited, see how maybe far away they are or where the gap is closing. So, I think it's a nice competition to have straight at the start of the season, straight in. But, I understand that you guys aren't, that fussed about it or don't think it's a big deal.
You know what? I think for me, it's just a little bit confusing. I think it's quite an interesting competition. I think it's great to get some of the younger players to get some minutes, those potentially who haven't been playing. But I need to be explained how the process actually works. I think the penalty situation just confuses me a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, we've had a fair few penalties this weekend.
It's been bonkers. I mean, the game I went to ended in penalties. The West Ham London City Lionesses, I think there was something like 26 penalties taken. I think something ridiculous like that. But I do like the competition. I like the idea of another cup. As you said, it's good for teams. You know, they play more football. Players will get more minutes. Maybe players who don't normally get as many minutes, you know, get more minutes. We saw last year how Carla Ward definitely used it for like her younger players at Aston Villa. Definitely not doing that this season for the cup because they came out strong against Man United. But I just think it's good. Allows them to maintain, you know, some momentum and allows teams lower down the league to play kind of bigger teams or championship teams to play bigger teams and challenge themselves. And that's, for me, how the game's going to grow.
Yeah, massively. And I think that's the best opportunity that there is for it. But I've got to agree with you, Claire. I mean, it is bloody confusing. I mean, they sort of changed it up last season that it was a draw at the end of the game, you go to penalties, you'd get 1 point just for going to penalties, and then you'd pick up a second point if you won the penalties. So as well as that, there's also a new format in the competition this year. I mean, Chelsea and Arsenal are exempt for playing the first round as they're playing the Champions League. And then the remaining 22 teams are split into two northern groups and three southern groups, and they then play a mini league, and then the best runner-up would join Chelsea and Arsenal in the quarterfinals. So if you can kind of get your head around that, it's definitely worth a watch. I think the next couple of games are going to be played in November and then I think in December. But you know, touching on some of the results this weekend, I mean, the big one that stands out for me, it's got to be Villa Man United. Villa taking it to a draw with Man United, Paris scoring in the 16th minute, and then Daly, a lovely little goal in the 72nd minute, taking it to penalties, and then the penalty shootout. I mean, Rach, what were your thoughts on that? There was quite a lot of drama.
Yeah, Villa really impressed me, actually. I thought they were good in the first half, but they were much better in the second. Like, they came out, they put their foot on the gas, they really limited Man United's opportunities, and I think probably a bit unlucky not to come away with the win in normal time. Anna Leet making her debut was absolutely unbelievable in goal. She made some cracking penalty saves. So did Sophie Bagley for Manchester United as well. But she also pulled out a stop in the 93rd minute, 1v1 against Ella Toon, and she made a super save. So a great debut for her. I was, really impressed with Villa's performance.
I've got to agree with you. I think they came out strong in the second half. I think the intensity across the midfield was massive for them. They brought on a sub, Brown, who I think added a lot of flair in the midfield and got a shot off, which hit the post. And then Skinner sort of trying to introduce Hannah Blundell, Hayley Ladd, Lucia Garcia to try and inject some kind of, passion and energy into the game. Because I think Man United did look flat at points. But, you know, with the penalty shootout going into, you know, Bagley sort of ended up being a bit of a hero, but ultimately being very frustrated by the fact that she saved three penalties only to have some of her best, level-headed, confident goal scorers not convert penalties. I just thought that was a bit of a shock, really. That should have been better, do you think?
You know what? I think when you step up and take a penalty, you never really, you can be full of confidence, and then before you know it, the ground can sink beneath your feet. I just, speaking from experiences, having missed penalties in quite important games, being incredibly confident going into them, I think normally it's the defenders who tend to be the best bet these days.
I mean, what in terms of kind of your experience, Claire, as a penalty taker, I mean, do you have any kind of like top tips or techniques or, you know?
Well, I soon went down the list, to be fair, Chloe. I think at first it was very much, I was quite young and fearless, so the expectation was, you know, more, I want to, you know, do something for my team, I want to win the game for them. And then I soon realised that, you know, left footers can't really take penalties, so I better just stop putting my hand up.
I think that is the fear. I think because the expectation is on the striker to score the penalty, the expectation is off the goalkeeper to save it. And I think, you know, for me, it always feels like a less pressurised situation because the odds are so stacked against me. But, you know, there's so much kind of information and behind the scenes footage and statistics about where penalty strikers are most likely to go. So, you know, I'm assuming Bagley did a lot of research to be able to save three penalties, but let down a bit by the squad.
Must be so hard though, like when so many penalties get taken, you get to a point where you're like, oh god, which way does she go? Who, like, I can't remember what they said in training. Like, I know I obviously didn't play football, so I can't give experience on that, but I was a goalkeeper in hockey and I know how she feels. I remember saving three goals in a penalty shootout and we still lost, so I can understand her frustrations.
But you've let it go, though. You don't sound bitter at all,
no,
Rachel.
No, not bitter at all.
No, not in the slightest, mate. Video on my face right now. Raging.
But I think, I mean, that wasn't the only sort of mad penalty shootout situation. I mean, West Ham went on to win against London City Lionesses. And, you know, the game ended 2-2 in full time. And it was Iceland's, I mean, I'm going to get this wrong in terms of the pronunciation of this, so bear with me.
Brynjarsdóttir.
Oh, wow. All right, Rach. All right, thanks for that. That helped.
Yes.
Who got the injury time equaliser to take it to pens. But, I mean, London City Lionesses, what an absolute result for them. Going up against a WSL squad. Obviously, London City have got quite a lot of experience in the sort of professional full-time outfit. So you'd expect that the standard wouldn't be so much that there'd be a massive gap there. But I just thought really impressive from them, Rach. Did you manage to catch the game at all?
No, just looking back on the FA player, but it sounded bonkers. I mean, it tells, this is why we love the Conti Cup. Quite hard to keep up with on Twitter while at another game. But yeah, I mean, I love it. This is great. And a great showing from London City Lionesses. It just shows you that, you know, you saw Birmingham beat Brighton. You know, teams from the Championship come up and really do something against WSL teams. It's brilliant.
No, absolutely. And I think, obviously, I mean, Claire, you spent some time at West Ham. Have you managed to kind of catch much of their performances this season, sort of last season? Do you think they've sort of come a long way in terms of where they were when you were playing for them?
Yeah, you know what? I don't really recognise them. I went to see Chelsea versus West Ham, and I think the investment in the whole infrastructure of West Ham has improved a lot. And with that, there's certain aspects which I just saw that I noticed straight away just from my time was more so the kind of just over the fitness levels of the players. And then on top of that, just kind of the buy-in. It looked like there was a big buy-in. Obviously, when we were playing, I think we obviously all bought into the ethos of the club. But it seems like there is a lot more professional nature that has been adopted. And I think recruitment has been great. They've obviously had quite a turnover of players. But I think, yeah, the growth. I think the first 40 minutes of that game versus Chelsea, they gave a good show for themselves. Obviously, they scored early as well. I give a shout out to Dan Bewitt, who's on the coaching staff there, who does some of the set pieces. Should be very happy with that. But yeah, I think overall they are closing that gap. And yeah, I think the recruitment, the quality of recruitment is a credit to that.
Absolutely. No, it's so nice to get some kind of input from, you know, someone who's been there, done it, been in and around the setup, and I suppose seen it grow. And I think, I mean, we've got a touch now on, you know, the next one, Birmingham, Brighton, 3-2 to Birmingham. Bit of an upset. Rach, did you manage to catch the game at all for that?
No, because they're all on at the same bloody time. So I was at your game. Crystal Palace.
Oh, did you not have
Bristol,
seven screens going on?
We're not going to talk about your game. But yeah, I was very
Thanks.
Impressed with Birmingham. And I think Brighton kind of had a bit of a comeback. I thought maybe they might snatch a draw at the end, but Birmingham are resilient and, you know, really impressed with them because we've seen in the Championship, they've taken points off some teams, but not off others. So sometimes it was a bit hard to really see how they were going to do in the Championship. So yeah, I think that's been a really good result from them because we similarly saw Brighton not start off well and then, you know, find their footing a little bit. So they've been knocked down a little bit by Birmingham. So it'll give Birmingham some confidence massively.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously going into the games in the next couple of weeks, I think, you know, Birmingham are one of those ones that you don't really know what you're going to expect until they're out there. But, you know, a few absolutely massive goals there. Jade Pennock being an absolute menace throughout the game, causing all kinds of upset for Brighton. But, you know, really impressive, actually. Really impressive game for them. I thought they looked strong. All right, so, I mean, the Champions League groups, we've just had sort of the big announcements about where everyone's going, where everyone's fitting. I mean, we discussed this briefly before the pod kicked off, and there is there's definitely a sense of groups of death this year. Arsenal are in Group C with Lyon, Juventus and Zurich. Group A is going to be Chelsea, PSG, Real Madrid and Vlaznia. Yes, Vlaznia.
Yes.
Group B, Wolfsburg, Slavia Prague, St. Poulton and Roma. And Group D, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Rosengard and Benfica. So, I mean, for me, I know which group I would want to be in. And it would probably be Group B. I mean, Rach, obviously, you caught some of the games with Arsenal playing Ajax over last week. How were things over there? How was it looking for Arsenal in their sort of campaign this season in the Champions League?
Well, it's been tough for them. The first leg, I think Arsenal probably should have put it away, should have won the first leg. It ended up being 2-2, so they had to go to Amsterdam and win that match. And it was a testy match, really unpleasant conditions, absolutely lashing rain. We had a whole weird issue of the goals being too short, something that Kim Little noticed in the warm-up because she's never normally able to touch the crossbar. So they had to get their ladders out before the game and try and fix the goals, which is quite an unusual thing to happen in the Champions League, and a bit suspicious. And they had the ladders out again at half time, so that was weird in itself. And it was Miedema who came up with the goal in the second half for them to win the game ultimately. But it was a tough game. It was a physical game. Beth Mead went off with what looked like a nasty head injury. Thankfully, she's okay now. But yeah, it was physical. And I think, you know, Ajax just are showing that there are plenty of teams now in Europe that are contenders to get into the Champions League. And that's why we're seeing so many groups that are so bloody hard. Like, three of those groups are groups of death. There's no question. And it's going to be tough for both Arsenal and Chelsea.
Yeah, I think when you look at, I mean, Arsenal's next game, they're going to be facing, you know, the Champions League holders, Lyon, and then going into Juventus as well. How do you think they're going to fare for that? I feel like, you know, they've bolstered the squad this year, a couple of great new signings, Hurtig coming in. You know, there's sort of this three-way partnership that's going on with, you know, Miedema, Blaksinius and Hurtig. Do you feel that this year could be the year that, you know, they really do some serious damage in the Champions League?
I think it's kind of hard to know from what we've seen from Arsenal so far, to be honest, because they played really well against Tottenham, and then they came out and they weren't brilliant against Ajax. They've lost Souza to injury. She's going to be out for a couple of weeks, and Leah Williamson is also pulled out of the England squad with injury. We don't really know what the nature of that injury is either. So there is also that element of what squad will be available for Arsenal against Lyon. I mean, of all games to kick off your Champions League group stage, away to the holders is probably not what you wanted. I just think they're going to need to be firing on all bloody cylinders if they want to get something out of that game.
I think that's the thing. I mean, there's absolutely no room for error. You either come and bring your A game, or you're going to be facing exit from the competition pretty quickly. And I think that's what the Champions League has become in the past couple of years, that you don't have a second chance, really. But I mean, Group A, we're sort of looking at Chelsea, PSG, Real Madrid and Vlasnia. Obviously, I'll touch on this with you, Claire. I mean, obviously, being an ex-Chelsea player, you must have seen so much progression with them. Obviously, you know, they made the 2021 final, but haven't made it in any other final in the UEFA competition. Do you think that this could be maybe their year? They've also recruited very well this year.
Yeah, you know what? I think the Chelsea are just desperate to win it. Obviously, winning three back-to-back league titles, the next progression for Emma Hayes and her team is to win that Champions League. So I think the group is difficult. Is it as difficult as Arsenal's group? I don't know. I think it matches it quite equally. But yeah, I think obviously we haven't progressed past the knockout rounds last season, so obviously missed out on that. And I do think it seems like there's almost becoming a bit of a mental block around the Champions League for Chelsea. Obviously, we were so close with that final against Barcelona a couple of years ago. But yeah, I think the recruitment-wise, the focus this season, 100%, will be Champions League. And you can see in the people that Emma Hayes has recruited and strengthening her team, the core of that team, the spine, in order to win these Champions League games.
Yeah, massively. And I think, you know, maybe it's going to be her lucky year. It's her 10th year in charge, achieved so much already. But I feel like it's that elusive title for her that I think is going to make her sort of give it that extra push. Obviously, Chelsea didn't start the WSL season too well, but I think they'll be looking to obviously make amends in this competition. And that'll be big for them. Yeah, touching then sort of briefly on Group D, we've got Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Rosengarten, Benfica. I mean, the only thing I can kind of point out about this is the slightly enjoyable Gareth Taylor derby here as Bronze and Walsh go up against Stanway. Yeah, what do you think we're going to expect in that kind of game, Rach?
Oh, that's going to be great, isn't it? That's going to be an exciting fixture. Bayern Munich have been doing well over the years, so they could push Barcelona close. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. That one's a bit of a group of death as well, a little bit. I mean, maybe slightly less group deathy than A and B, but still a tough group all the same. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. I'm looking forward to seeing Georgia Stanway playing in Champions League for Bayern Munich as well. A different type of football for her, so it should be a good matchup.
absolutely love that. It's the less deathy group of death out of all of the groups of death in this competition. I think that's a great way to sum up what's happened in the Champions League this year.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Just a note that the following section contains reference to sexual abuse and harassment. All right, so big news in the NWSL that's just come about. I think it was released night before.
Last night.
Obviously, some really harrowing things have been emerging from the Sally Yates report on abuse in women's soccer. I mean, this time last year, NWSL players protested mid-matches as allegations of sexual abuse, harassment and bullying rocked the league. And now a report from Sally Yates to look into these allegations. I mean, her report is massive, over 319 pages long. She interviewed over 200 players, and the summary basically included, or was, you know, the comments that were made. You know, abuse in the NWSL is rooted in a deeper culture in women's soccer, beginning in youth leagues, that normalises verbally abusive coaching and blurs the boundaries between coaches and players. I mean, this is huge. You know, the ripple effect of this report, I'm hoping, is going to you know, really make people understand what's been going on for the past however many years, and that it's not just at elite level, it's from everything from elite down to grassroots and into youth leagues. You know, Claire, have you managed to sort of see much of the report?
Yeah, I mean, I read a few articles that have been reported around this situation, and I just think it's just absolutely tragic. I think the, you know, this really slow to react from some of the outcomes I can see, and just a whole kind of review of a player care needs to be reviewed in women's sport by the looks of it.
And in terms of kind of Claire, your experiences with, you know, being at such elite WSL clubs in your time, what kind of player of care have you kind of seen in around those clubs? What things, or was there sort of set up and infrastructure there at the time when you were there?
Yeah, to be honest, it's probably one criticism that I would have is probably just a lack of that infrastructure, a lack of process maybe around how you can report some of these issues. And I guess in football, because it's based on opinion, there's almost a fear factor that is involved in reporting some of these issues. You know, will it jeopardise your role in the team, etc., etc.? There's a kind of like a power play, isn't there? However, I do think that infrastructure around some of these sporting teams does need to be reviewed. There needs to be clear processes, and there needs to be a swift and efficient structure in order to make sure if reports are dealt with quickly, and before we even get to there, just deal with the source as it is and make sure that their people are properly vetted.
I think that's the thing. I know, Rachel, when we sort of discussed this pre-pod, we were kind of talking about, you know, where their accountability is going to be and why there is this sense that, you know, coaches who have committed these kinds of crimes can just freely go from another club to another club and just continue to sort of, you know, perpetuate the abuse and harassment. I mean, you've obviously read through the report, you've read loads of articles on it. What was sort of coming out or jumping out for you about this?
Well, the thing I find most shocking is that these organisations think that they can retain these kinds of reports in-house and deal with it in-house. Like, you know, you see it at universities over there as well. Similarly, it's something that they want to handle internally, which personally I think is wild, especially when there is this complete lack of accountability. And the main objective seems to be protecting the club as opposed to protecting the victim. So a lot of the things that are done with the objective of protecting the club in, you know, the media, etc. And ultimately what you've ended up doing is making things absolutely 10 times worse, because you're just moving around effectively these predators into other situations and putting more people at risk. There was a line in the report that probably one of the toughest lines. There was a lot of tough parts of it, but there, in some of the articles I read, one of the lines that stood out for me was that the report states that players, coaches and staff were conditioned to accept and respond to abusive coaching behaviours as youth players. By the time they reach the professional level, many do not recognise the conduct as abuse. And I just, that is so, so grim. Like, to be conditioned to that kind of abuse is disgraceful, and it makes the accounts of the players who then have come forward all the more harrowing, and worse still, that many of these accounts were largely ignored. Like, if you're in an organisation where you're putting forward these accounts and they're being ignored, it makes it almost, you know, it's so brave to do that. But for these people to keep coming forward, almost kind of knowing they're going to be ignored, makes it all the more brave. And I just, yeah, it's heartbreaking, really, the whole thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, as an example of, you know, what you were just touching on there, I mean, you know, Paul Riley, the former Portland Thorns coach, was fired after repeated allegations of sexual misconduct. But, I mean, the Thorns didn't even make this public, didn't pass this on from this information on to North Carolina Courage, to where he'd moved. So you do have this sense of, you know, you can kind of get away unnoticed with what you do in one club and have a completely clean slate when you start at another club. I mean, I know there was a number of conclusions that were kind of outlined, you know, a number of recommendations that were sort of aimed at preventing abuse in future. You know, sort of, Claire, what were your kind of thoughts on, you know, how we learn from this going forwards?
Yeah, I think you touched on there just the duty of care. The way that these managers are being passed around without any accountability actually just makes me feel a bit sick to think that. But I think for me that the instant responses need to be a review of anyone who's in a position of power. Obviously different, obviously when you're employing someone, how you actually vet that person. And then just the whole infrastructure, you know, what are the processes? Do the players know exactly what the processes are in order to report something like this? How can we empower the players to feel like they do have a voice? As I said before, there can be a bit of a, you can think twice about it because you think it might jeopardise your place in a team or something like that. So I do think there needs to be a almost like a whistleblower program where players, I don't know whether it's led by the league or whether it's led by individual clubs. I would tend to look more so at the league in order to actually make sure you're covering all the bases here. But I think that is probably the best process in order to prevent some of these situations occurring again.
Yeah, massively. And I think it is that kind of safeguarding infrastructure and the ability of players to feel that they're in a trusted environment where if they come forward, they're going to be believed. You know, I mean, obviously myself as a player, you know, if there are things that are going on behind the scenes, and this is not a reference to any kind of abuse at all, but just things that aren't quite right at the club or things that, you know, you think that conditions could be improved or resources or whatever it is. I mean, there's never, ever been that sense of it's been OK to talk about it. And I think it was quite refreshing last week, obviously off the back of what happened with the Spanish national team. And there were 15 players there who sort of collectively combined, wrote that email to the federation to kind of say, well, we're not happy with how things are going, and to use their platform to say this is what they were going to do about it. And I feel like, you know, an empowering moment like that, I'm hoping, is going to then transcend into other national teams, and on the back of this report and the recommendations that have been outlined, that this will hopefully take things forward and like you said, Claire, kind of empower people going forwards.
I will say, I think it should make us look at sport as a whole and how we treat sport as a whole and how we treat players and clubs and what we deem important and the most important things. And in a lot of these situations, the most important thing is the sport, the most important thing is the club, and it's not the people. You know, players often get treated, we touched on it in the discussion earlier, Claire, about like commodities, you know. And at the end of the day, that should be the biggest priority. It shouldn't be, you know, oh, well, you might damage the football team or you might damage the reputation of the club by coming forward with something like this. That shouldn't ultimately be the priority. The priority should be the person who's been a victim. And I think sometimes we can allow sport to be above everything else. You know, this isn't going to be the only country that this comes out of. You know, I think we're going to see this in more countries. And I think it should make clubs look at the way that they treat these situations. And rather than just thinking about protecting the club, and we've seen it in the men's game here, protecting the club, it should be about the victims first and foremost. And I think sometimes we get a little bit carried away about sport and we think it's the most important thing. And it sometimes then taints the way that these situations are handled.
Yeah, I mean, I think what would be amazing, I think, Rach, you kind of touched on it just there, was, you know, not to have this kind of reactive approach to, obviously you need this kind of report to expose this kind of abuse. But, you know, for other countries where maybe, you know, this kind of thing isn't going on, I don't think there's a sense that we can be complacent that it won't ever happen. So, you know, putting in place those processes, doing a report, doing a bit of an audit about how things are now would be a fantastic thing to see across more countries, across more nations, to hopefully prevent similar things occurring. You mean, I think it was quite the conclusions and, you know, the recommendations that were made, you know, holding wrongdoers accountable, enhancing transparency, fostering a professional environment, you know, and sort of better vetting of coaches as well, I think is absolutely going to be
or
key.
Or any vetting of coaches.
Or any, yeah, just any vetting of, you know, any basic vetting of coaches would obviously, you know, hopefully prevent things like this happening in future. But I think also one of the most worrying things about this report was just the sort of the clubs failing to provide documents or coercing witnesses. So it was like,
because the club is the most important thing.
It's manipulation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think, as you touched on there, Chloe, the transparency. I mean, it's something that massively is lacking in football. I think the transparency in all different levels, you know, let alone kind of the basic human needs of a player. I think that's where sports and football is really lacking. Because I can certainly speak as being feeling like almost just tradable, because you are tradable, and I think sometimes you can feel like that, which takes away your power.
Mm. I think it's that there's such a vulnerability, I think, with being a football player sometimes. The contracts are short. You don't know whether speaking up is going to affect your position on the pitch, on the team. And especially now, you know, for younger players, I think the pressure is so much more because they're, you know, trying to make a good impression, wanting to do everything the coaches are saying, the managers are saying. And I think that leads to such an unusual power dynamic. And especially where you've got, you know, so many young players now that are being managed by, you know, groups of men in a lot of occasions in the WSL and Championship. And I think, you know, you can't get away from that being an environment that you know, you need to just keep a really close eye on and make sure that everything is above board. But yeah, warning, it's an upsetting read. It doesn't make for a good read at all. But no, thanks for sharing your thoughts and comments on that, guys. I appreciate that's not an easy one to touch on. Next up, I mean, we've got England, USA. You couldn't ask for a better Friday night. I mean, a couple of things have happened, a couple of game changes. Alicia Russo has just been withdrawn from the squad through injury. Leah Williamson as well, just pulling out today. Chloe Kelly and Fran Kirby are back in after missing the September qualifiers. It's going to be a sold out crowd. I think it's going to, you know, the atmosphere, I think, is going to be, I mean, nothing's going to compare to the Euros finals. But, you know, that kind of crowd at a Wembley Stadium with, you know, the reigning World Cup champs, first time these teams have played each other at Wembley. I mean, what can we expect here? I mean, Claire, were you at the Women's Euros game? Were you at the final? Did you kind of get that?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely incredible. I don't know how you're going to top that, but I mean, I'm expecting it on Friday. Yeah, I think the fans, obviously coming back to Wembley, it's sold out. Also, a little teaser, if you guys didn't know, there's all the ex-Lionesses are doing a march around the pitch at halftime. So it's going to be a bit of a throwback to kind of where the game has been and where it's at now, which is really a nice touch. Yeah, so there'll be some old faces and some people who have really changed the game, and then we combine that with, you know, our players having just won the Euros. What a great celebration it is. I'm super excited.
Are you going to the game, Claire? You're going to be there?
Oh yeah, I'm doing my King's Wave.
Yeah. I mean, just to put some context, we can't currently see Claire on camera. But if we did, we'd most certainly be asking you to do a practice run of that. We might get you to do that just afterwards.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. No worries.
But yeah, Rachel, you're going as well. What do you think we're going to expect at the game?
Well, what makes this really exciting is that, like, in the past, it used to always be a big deal for England to play the US, right? Because the US were the best team in the world, so it was always really exciting. But it feels like it's almost a quid pro quo now. Like, for the USA, they get to play the European champions at Wembley, sold out crowd. Like, it's just as big for both teams, and I think that makes it really, really exciting. So yeah, I'm just fireworks, I suppose. I'm sure there might be literal fireworks, pyrotechnics of some sort, but I just think it's going to be a really exciting atmosphere. Maybe a little bit concerned with some of the injuries, a little bit concerned with the likes of Leah Williamson being out, and Alessia Russo, makes me maybe a little bit nervous just in terms of that leadership, but there are a lot of leaders in the squad, so I just think it's gonna be a great match. Like, hats off to the FA, because they announced that straight after the Euros win and the tickets were gone so fast. So it was an excellent move by them, and I reckon it'll live up to the hype.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the kind of crowd you're expecting, like you said, there's going to be so much, there's probably going to be DJs and fan zones and that kind of stuff popping off all around the stadium. I mean, Claire, you've obviously, you know, played in situations like that, big crowds, big atmosphere, you know, a lot of pressure on your shoulders. I mean, what's it like kind of getting that call up to the squad and playing in front of a crowd like that?
Yeah, you know what, it just never gets old. That from the first time where I got called up when I was sharing a room with Ellen White when we were at uni, our first ever senior call up. I remember screaming.
You shared a room with Ellen White?
Yeah, that for is... 3 years. Poor me.
Wow.
I remember our first call up, yeah, it was kind of, we used to get emails in, so it was we both just stood up and we didn't know whether the other one had got in, so it'd like, we'd look at each other, both smiled and just screamed. And I think every single time it's been the same feeling. So yeah, I think it's like the initial, you know, selection, you're like, oh, buzzing. You actually had to then get picked for the team and picked, you know, prove yourself in training. And then obviously that occasion where you know, you've got the nerves a couple of days before. I'd like to say it gets easier, but it doesn't. I think it's equally as exciting and nerve-wracking at the same time. I remember I used to try not to think about the game. I used to ask what are the details of my role, what do you expect from me, and then I would say I don't want to talk about it too much more, because I'd be someone who would obsess over the opposition and I'd want to know every single detail about them, and sometimes that's not that good because it can just lead to a little bit more nerves. So yeah, I think the whole kind of crowd, the buzz outside, obviously all the all the pubs, you know, we were with people filled with England shirts on. I think I've seen that only a couple of times whilst I was playing. Obviously, the game was growing. My particular favourite was in Canada when we beat Canada.
I was hoping you were going to bring that up.
2015 World Cup.
Yes.
That's my favourite. It's my favourite one ever.
I remember that game, and I remember...
Were you? Of course you were. Of course you were.
We were right down the front, and like we had a sing-song with you at the end, because we had a chant for you. I remember that.
Yes.
So I was going to ask you about that, because that atmosphere was insane.
Go on, give us a chant. Go on. Do you remember it?
I do, yeah.
No, don't.
We always sing on this podcast, but I think people get sick of it, to be honest. But it was basically to the tune of Cheerleader.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good one.
There we go.
Nice. And I think obviously like you touched on there about, you know, what it's like kind of the lead up to the game. I mean, are you one of those players like once you're on the pitch, you kind of, you know, zone the crowd out, or do you kind of use the crowd as, you know, you're kind of, everyone keeps talking about it, but, and I don't want to say this cheesy line, but the 12th woman.
You know what? I think once you step on the pitch, it sounds it's weird to say, but you kind of just like engulfed in your own world. It's like the noise is in a dream or something, and you're just kind of so hyper focused on the game. I think playing at Wembley, playing FA Cups there, playing Olympics. Obviously, we had there. I think Wembley itself has got its own persona. I think obviously the stories that have been told there recently with obviously the Lionesses winning the Euros, I think that gives it an extra kind of bite and energy that I haven't experienced. But what I did experience was that I think obviously playing for Chelsea in some of the bigger games, having that loyal fan base cheering you on, then playing for England and winning the World Cups, that the energy you do get, and it's kind of like a split second. You'll for me, it was whenever I'd go and take a throw-in, which I used to hate, by the way. I hate throw-ins for some reason. Obviously, as left back, I used to always have to take throw-ins, but as soon as I stepped out the pitch, it's like I would then hear the noise and the roar of the crowd again. So yeah, it's strange. It's like stepping in and out of a portal.
That's such a fantastic insight into like the life of, like, you know, what you have to deal with like on the pitch when you're dealing with like big crowds like that. And you know, I've only ever faced it once in my life, really, and like the biggest thing for me was, you know, especially because you're at the back, not being able to hear your players in front of you and how you deal with, you know, even just communicating with each other on the pitch when the fans are, you know, popping off with their Mexican waves or chants or whatever it is. So it's a bit of a crazy environment, but I'm just so glad that we're seeing so much more of it now, and, you know, more players starting to experience big occasions like that. And also, I mean, we've got to touch on the fact that, you know, Nikita Paris, we've had a few injuries that have happened in a very short space of time, but really excited to see Nikita Paris being called in to replace Leah Williamson and Lucy Parker. And obviously just off the back of, you know, a fantastic weekend for Paris, do you think, you know, this is going to be her sort of call up? Do you think she's going to be, you know, in the starting team given what's happened at the weekend?
She might be, yeah, especially given, you know, Alessia Russo's isn't playing, but I think Paris often plays a bit more of a winger role for England. But, you know, we saw her score for England in the last international break, I think goals that she really deserved, and I think she had a tough time at Arsenal. We touched on that before. Got her first goal for Man United, so hopefully this is all things going the right way for Nikita Paris, and she'll get a chance in this international break as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well. I mean, Serena said that the door is still open for Steph Horton as well. Obviously, we've not seen her play with England for quite some time now. I mean, Claire, have you played with Steph before? You know, I know she's sort of in a bit of a transitional phase this year, still playing for obviously Man City. But to me, it kind of looked like she was sort of taking maybe more of a backseat role with the England squad with not being the call up for the summer.
Yeah, I've played with Steph many times. Also went to uni with her as well. So we went to like a player development centre. So we'd kind of trained together for 4 years. So that was kind of a good experience. But it's a difficult time in someone's career when you kind of hit the stage where it just gets out of your control. You know, you get injuries. You can't really control your situations of your body. Your body's kind of letting you down a little bit, and then you're always playing catch up in a game that's always moving forward. And that's how I felt anyway. I can't obviously speak for Steph, but I'm sure it's quite an emotional time, but one that you have to expect as a footballer. I mean, she obviously had a fantastic career, and I wouldn't write her off, because Steph Horton is you know, a very strong-minded individual, and I wouldn't be surprised to see her back in the England squad. But yeah, I think when you come to this stage in your career, I always felt like I just couldn't get back to where I was, because I was injured all the time. And then the game was moving forward, it was getting quicker and quicker. and I was getting slower and slower given all the injuries, and it's difficult emotionally. It's really difficult emotionally.
Yeah, I think your comments definitely resonate with me. I mean, I've retired in a very small way compared to the likes of yourself. I think it's that weird scenario where you kind of see the talent that's coming through and all the, you know, the strength and conditioning, the resources, facilities, and all the kind of sports science that's now in place that wasn't in place when I started playing football when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And, you know, like you said, I mean, I had a couple of injuries last year, like torn ligaments, broken fingers and things. And I just felt that I was kind of breaking down. And you kind of get to the stage where you kind of want to go out gracefully, but you also know that you always feel like there's one last game in you that you can keep on carrying on and seeing where you kind of get to. But I mean, you touched on there sort of the injuries that you'd had. So unfortunate with the three ACL injuries. How did that kind of impact you? How were you kind of feeling when that all happened? Because that was just such a lot to go through.
Yeah, to be honest, it was, I think at the time, each one I kind of took in my stride. The first one, I was quite young, I was like 16, and little did I know that it would have, end up shaping my whole career, because consequently, you do a massive injury like an ACL, then your whole structure of how you run changes, you use your muscles differently, you have to compensate constantly, and that, unfortunately, has had repercussions in my career. I had to retire relatively early. I had to, sit and watch my teammates I grew up with still playing. So I retired at 30, which I think is quite early. I think if I hadn't had them injuries, I would have kept going for another 3 years maybe. It kind of got I was more aware towards the end of my career when, I was just always playing catch up. And then I got a bit kind of just frustrated and maybe a little bit resentful actually towards myself, because I was always injured and then always never able to fulfill my potential or what I felt like I could achieve. And that was through no fault of my own, which can be quite frustrating. A lot of injuries. So three ACLs.
It's interesting you say that, because from my perspective, I always looked at you as how incredible it was that you were still playing. I think I was there for your third ACL injury. I think I remember that one. And I think for maybe us looking in, you may have found it obviously understandably frustrating, but I remember thinking, oh my God, she's playing for England. She's done her ACL three times. This is incredible. Like that was such an amazing thing when I looked at it from that perspective. And, we've talked about ACLs in this show before, probably not in too much depth, but they seem to be almost endemic in the women's game. There was obviously a lot of big names with their ACL injuries before the Euros. We had Katoto during the Euros, Piteous beforehand, Simone McGill did hers as well. Kaya Simon has just announced today for Tottenham has done her ACL. I think we had Lucy Watson at Chelsea, Hannah Godfrey at Charlton, Jane Ross for Scotland. Like, that's just the last few weeks. And it just seems crazy that not enough is being done to kind of research this.
Yeah, there is not. There is just not enough research into the female body, hormones, how that can affect your bones and your muscles, how it can affect your training patterns, obviously menstrual cycle, everything. There's so many different factors that add up to optimal and elite performance that we just don't have the knowledge and the detail yet. And I don't think we'll see that for another, maybe five, six, 7 years, because it takes time to collect that detail. And it's like we're always, obviously the profession of the women's game, I think that has obviously affected the amount of research, because it wasn't high up on the agenda or the list of priorities. So subsequently, we've suffered massively. And unfortunately, I think this ends up in a higher rate of injury. And don't get me started on them ACLs and periods and how our hips are aligned. It's just not fair.
I mean, they're massively important topics, and I think it's not just the impact of the physical injury itself and the damage that does to your body. And the rehab period is such a long period of time. You're out for a season, maybe a season and a half. You go through surgery, but as well as that, you're also not with the squad. You're in the strength and conditioning coach's room, or you're in the physio room, and you're not enjoying the kind of squad experiences that you get from being a part of the team. And I think it's that emotional kind of isolation that I think can sometimes be really difficult as well. So I think, you know, as well as the data that people are gathering on injuries, and hopefully we see more of that start to come out, I think there also needs to be like a big push in terms of kind of the emotional welfare of athletes who are going through injuries, because it's it's pretty hardcore. It's pretty hard sometimes. I don't know how you found it, Claire, sort of going through that emotionally, the mental impact of it, and whether you had sort of you know, physio buddies or someone that you could kind of you know, get that support from.
Yeah, I mean, being injured is a very, very lonely place. There's a lot of isolated training. There's a lot of, you know, you're training, you're allowed to join in little bits of training sessions, but not all, and then you're just having to train at different times. And mental health wise, it can massively impact you. I think, to be honest, mine at the time didn't impact me as much as it has done post career, because I found like that I actually hadn't dealt with maybe some of my frustrations, and that's what leaked out post when I retired, because I'm kind of done with football and I felt like I shouldn't be. So I think the long-term impact of injuries and how that can affect your mental health, as well as the short-term impact, is very, very important. And it needs to be prioritised, actually. I think people need to look after these players, and I think that goes back to what we were saying just about the processes of player welfare.
Yeah, massively. And I think, you know, just to touch on there, obviously, after your retirement, you went on to work with Chelsea. You were commercial manager with Chelsea. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yeah. I was dealing with some of the sponsorships, so sponsorship sales manager within the commercial team. So, yeah, I retired. And then the next week I joined the commercial team. So I didn't really give myself much time to take that step away. But yeah, I think it was a fantastic opportunity, great role. I learned a lot from it, but I decided that I think having been at the club for such a long time and feeling like that was kind of who I was, I needed to kind of find out who I was myself without Chelsea. So I've been through quite a bit of a process in doing that, and has taken a little bit of a step away from football, actually, just to kind of find out who I am, really, which has been interesting, to say the least.
Love that. And now you're working in transfers, but in the men's side of the game. How's that been going so far?
Yeah, it's great. So a company called Transfer Room, obviously we're working on the transparency within the marketplace, and it's an online platform that just opens the doors to clubs and agents in order to get deals done. And yeah, I think it's something actually that I think it would be really useful in the women's game for that transparency aspect. I think I would have loved to have been able to be on a platform and chosen which club I would be able to go to next. I think when I come to the end of my career, I didn't really have any options. I think it will be something hopefully for women's football in the future. I think it is fantastic for the whole game. Just that transparency of the money that's kind of involved in transfers and the open conversations that sometimes we don't see.
No, it's often hush-hush.
Yeah, I mean, we're starting to see these big transfer, this big transfer money happening in the women's game now, sort of record-breaking figures from this season in terms of, you know, players coming over and being bought. So, watch this space. Claire Rafferty leading the way on the women's transfer market. I can't wait to see it. I think that's probably the best place to finish up, because that is just, that's unreal. But thank you so much for sharing your journey with us, Claire, and, you know, for coming on, speaking really openly and honestly about, you know, the impact of injuries. I know it's always an emotional topic, sort of talking about your retirement and things like that. So
really insightful.
Yeah, really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, that's it, gang. Thanks for listening to Upfront. If you've got any questions for us, hit us up on Twitter at Morgie_89 or at Girls on the Ball or at CLRafferty1. We will see you next week.
Upfront is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, mate.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.